Welcome to the Redeemer Central podcast. Redeemer Central is a church community in Belfast seeking to practice the way of Jesus and work for the peace and good of our city. For more information, please visit redeemercentral.com.
It's lovely to see you all again this morning, and as Dave said, I kind of feel like Ray Stevens when he sang that song, "It's Me Again, Margaret," and I'm rocking this handlebar moustache at the moment, and Dave Anderson actually said that it kind of reminded him of a 1981 RUC officer, so I don't know how true that is, but it's good to see you all, and just before we get into it this morning, I just want to share with you a little incredible thing that happened this past week. So as you know, Dan has mentioned, we're moving into this new learning group this incoming week, and I kind of took it as a bit of a confirmation what happened this past week, that this was the right move at this season. So last week when I was here and we were talking a little bit about the whole new learning group, sexuality and inclusion, I kind of shared with you a little bit about my own experience as a young person, kind of coming to terms with myself at that stage and about the wounding that came and the rejection and almost being kicked out of that youth group because of those feelings. And how that experience at the age of 18 kind of set me on a very troubled path for a long many a year. And I was sharing with that with you last week, and I haven't heard or seen anyone from that youth group in almost 25 years. And would you believe, after saying that to you last week, this past week, I got a text out of the blue from a leader in that youth group who used to be in that youth group at the time. Now, if you'd have asked me this time last week, of all the people in that group, who is the least person that you'd think would ever be supportive, I would have said this person. And yet, out of the blue, this past week, they sent me a text message to say that they wanted to be back in touch again, to acknowledge the pain that had been caused 25 years ago, and to apologize for it, and to say that they recognized that, you know, what had been done was very poor, and they would like to meet up and to be reconciled and be in touch, and that they themselves have been on a journey of healing and restoration, and that came completely out of the blue. And so we're going to arrange to meet up with them on lunch soon, for lunch some of these days. So it just goes to show you that as you go on your journey, possibilities emerge that you never thought possible. I think it was Ralph Waldo Emerson that said, "The mind, once stretched to a new dimension, can never shrink back to its original size." So just bear that in mind as we go forward in the week ahead. So as Dan has mentioned as well, this is our second week now on the practice of solitude. And David reminded us last week that solitude is not loneliness. It's not isolation. It's not even aloneness, you know, me time. But rather what he said last week was that it is intentional time spent in quietness with ourselves and God. And so in that sense, then it becomes a place of encounter with ourselves, with God, and also with something a little bit more ominous. And that's what we're going to look at today. So our passage for this morning is Matthew chapter 4, the first 11 verses. I'm going to read it to you. "Then Jesus was led up by the Spirit into the wilderness to be tempted by the devil. He fasted 40 days and 40 nights, and afterward he was famished. The tempter came and said to him, 'If you are the Son of God, command these stones to become loaves of bread.' But he answered, 'It is written, one does not live by bread alone, but by every word that comes from the mouth of God.' And then the devil took him to that holy city, placed him on the pinnacle of the temple, and said to him, 'If you are the Son of God, throw yourself down, for it is written, he will command his angels concerning you, and on their hands they will bear you up, so that you will not dash your foot against a stone.' Jesus said to him, 'Again, it is written, do not put the Lord your God to the test.' Again, the devil took him to a very high mountain and showed him all the kingdoms of the world and their glory. And he said to him, all these I will give you if you will fall down and worship me. Then Jesus said to him, away with you, Satan, for it is written, worship the Lord your God and serve him only. And then the devil left him, and suddenly angels came and waited on him. Now, I don't know how you imagine this scene. I still have a picture of it imprinted on my mind from an illustrated children's Bible that I used to have when I was a kid. And the nearest I found to it is the picture that we have on the slide behind me today. But here Jesus was at the very beginning of his public ministry. His hair was still wet from his baptism. Remember, there were no chapter breaks in the original manuscripts. And so this episode just flowed on from the previous episode, which was his baptism in the River Jordan by John. Whenever the heavens opened and the Spirit fell on him like a dove. And yet no sooner did he come out of that than that same dove led him away from the river and into the desert with the voice of God still ringing in his ears. This is my beloved Son, in whom I am well pleased. And that was before he'd done anything, ever worked a miracle or taught a discourse. There was just this affirmation of sheer delight and pleasure and this public declaration of sonship. But you know, it's one thing to be told something about yourself, and it's another thing to really know it deep down in an internalized way. And sometimes that knowledge comes the hard way. And remember that Jesus was every inch a human. He didn't go around with a bright halo above his head or anything. And so he must have wrestled and struggled with his identity as he emerged into maturity, coming to realize who he was. And at this dramatic moment of his baptism, the voice from above declared it. But it wouldn't be until this desert experience was over that truth would really dawn upon him. And that's where it would be worked into him through testing. And that's why we read that it was the Spirit that led him there. Because there are some things that can only be revealed through a test. And you that are teachers know that very well. So you teach a module for a season. And then how do you find out how much your young people have absorbed from what you've taught? You give them a test. And there's nothing about tests that are fun. Especially when they're sprung on you without warning. Whenever the teacher says, right, put away your books. Take out a blank piece of paper. Tests are difficult. They're stressful. But they reveal the truth of what's inside you. Jesus didn't go into the desert on his own initiative. He didn't wander there by mistake. The Spirit led him into the battle to reveal the truth to him about who he really was and to ratify what had been declared at the river. Now, did you notice from the text in verse 2 that the battle came at the end of those 40 days? And the way that I've always read that is that he came to him at his weakest, when he was absolutely famished and at his most vulnerable point. That the tempter knew better than to come at the start when he was fresh and well fed. That he probably watched him from a distance for those first few weeks. First while, you know, he said his prayer standing up. And then his legs gave out with the hunger and he had to sit down. And then finally near the end, he said them lying flat on the ground, and then that's when the devil knew it was time to start, when Jesus had run out of all his own resources and he might be open to receiving a little help. But you know what I just realized this past week, actually, is that all this time I've been reading that backwards. That yes, after 40 days, physically, his strength must have been gone, but spiritually, he must have been at the height of his powers. Because only then did he have the strength to overcome the tempter. Contrary to all suppositions, the desert is the place of strength. I don't know if anyone here has ever been to a real desert before. In 2007, I had the privilege of going to Israel on a tour. One day we took the coach from Jerusalem all the way down to the south, to the Dead Sea. And the Dead Sea is right in the middle of desert. And I'll never forget it. It was absolutely stifling hot. It was about 41 degrees that day. And for miles around, there was nothing, only cracked and barren desert, just an odd cactus and shrub here and there, but that was about it. My friend and I decided to take a bit of a wander out into the desert, obviously not too far, because as an ephetophobe, there are things that live in the desert that I don't ever want to see. And there were a couple of things that struck me about the desert. First thing was how quiet it was. It was so quiet that I could almost hear the racket of my own body. Every thump and wheeze and gurgle. Did you know that if you can get quiet enough, you can actually hear the hum of your own electricity? Your body makes as much noise as the motor of a small electric clock. Apparently, there's a laboratory room in Cambridge University that's fitted out with gear that makes it so quiet that you can actually hear the sound of your eyeballs moving. Isn't that an inspiring thought? Most of us don't realize that we're making that much noise. But in the desert, it's so quiet, you can hear yourself. Second thing I noticed about the desert is how lonely it is. Miles and miles around with nobody and nothing. You know, there's something about a desert that can suck all the self-confidence right out of you, because it's so big and so quiet, so empty, that you can't help but notice how small and perishable you are. You remember that you're dust, and to the dust you shall return. And you just wish that you had something or someone to distract you from all of that, or at least someone to kind of talk to you about it, anyone that is except for the devil. And then the third thing I noticed about the desert was the flies. Now, I know Matthew doesn't mention flies, but based on my own experience, I'm almost certain if it didn't constitute a fourth temptation, at least it made the other three harder to bear. Because there's nothing that can quite try your spirit like a fly. Can I hear an amen to that? Whether it's a mosquito, definitely a blue bottle. And so there I was in the desert, trying to be all holy and to walk the Bible way. And all I could think about was that bleep, bleep, bleeping fly circling around my head or buzzing in my ear or trying to crawl up my nose. There's nothing that can try you like a fly. Okay, so you think you're spiritual? Well, then try one of these on for size. Now listen, my desert experience isn't really that much to write home about. I was only there for an hour or two before getting the coach back up the road again. But I tell you about it as a kind of a snapshot into what the desert is. It's a quiet place. It's a lonely, vulnerable place. And it's a place where the devil comes nipping at your heels. And if you've ever been stranded there a while, I bet one of the things you know is how much you can wonder where God is. I wonder, is that how it was for Jesus? You know, he'd just come from his baptism, where everyone present had seen the sky break open, watched the dove descend, heard the voice from above declaring him to be God's own son. It was dramatic, it was spectacular, it was sensational. You might imagine that after something like that, he would go from strength to strength as the emergence of a kind of superhero bursting onto the stage. But instead, that's not what happened. Instead, he went from that spectacular moment to a long, lonely time in the wilderness, or as Dave taught us last Sunday, the Eremos. And for 40 days and nights, there was no sign of God at all. And the sky stayed shut, and there were no doves, and there was no voice from heaven speaking reassuring words. There was just him, and the desert, and finally, the devil. Now, in my children's Bible, on this slide behind, it kind of pictures the devil in this kind of black get-up with almost gargoyle-looking features. And that's how I imagined it for a long time, but I don't anymore. Because now I think that the way evil works is a lot more mysterious and ambiguous than the way sometimes it gets depicted in Christian circles. I come from a background where people blamed the devil an awful lot, and they kind of saw the demonic under every stool. So you got a flat tire on your way to work, and that's the enemy, that's the enemy. And to be frank, a lot of it was just vivid imagination. But these days now, I do think that we do well to dismiss a lot of that silliness, but to pay attention to the claim that the reality in which we find ourselves really is pervaded with a spiritual form of evil that is mysterious, that is destructive, and that runs at times through every human heart. And whatever that is, the way it gets presented in the Bible is through this figure called the devil. Now, how did the battle come? Well, it came through voices. So don't imagine, you know, this being like a scene out of a Marvel movie. You know, Thor battling Thanos from the Avengers. I had to Google that there. That's not anything. Don't imagine that to be that way. Rather, imagine it to be like a conversation. Imagine it to be like clashing voices up here. Now, you've already read the conversation. I don't want to unpack it too much. But first of all, there was the temptation to doubt God's care for him. Oh, really? The Son of God out here alone, starving to death? You call that being well pleased with you? What a joke. Sure, why don't you do a little magic and turn these rocks into bread and look after yourself? Then there came the second temptation to test God's care for him. Sure, throw yourself down. If you really are so precious, not even your toe will stub the ground. Doesn't your Bible promise that? Go ahead. I dare you. I double dare you. Check and see if you mean as much to him as he claims. And then the third temptation, to walk away from God's plan for him. Look, who needs to go through all this? All this testing, all this stretching, all this scrutiny. Why don't you just settle your destiny right now? I'll offer you a shortcut. Sure, fall down, worship me. I'll give you the control of all the kingdoms of the world. Can you see the one binding factor that follows in all these testings? How that in them all, there's a subtle suggestion that Jesus deserved a whole lot more than what God was giving him. Do you notice the language 2 times out of 3? If you're the Son, if you're really the Son of God. So why should the Son of God be starving? Why should the Son of God as much as bruise his toe? Why should he be subject to the Caesars and the rulers of this world? The rulers and Caesars of this world should be subject to him. Clearly God is holding out on you. It's the language of Genesis 3, isn't it? And so the devil suggested that if God couldn't do much better by a son than that, then maybe it was time for the son to shop around for a new allegiance or a new father. Now listen, if this didn't land on Jesus in some way, it could hardly be called a real test. You see, in my Calvinist background, I was taught that not only did Jesus not succumb to sin, but he was so stainless, he could not have succumbed. But that never made sense to me, because what would be the point of this then? It's only a test if he's sorely tempted. Tempted to rise above the hunger, the danger, the helplessness of what it means to be a human, and to see something better for himself. So to magically turn the rocks into breakfast for himself, or to treat God like a genie in a bottle who just appears at his every whim. Or to install himself as the president of the world. He is the Son of God after all. This was the great battle. And it might have gone very differently, but it didn't. And as a result, this is a story in which everyone finds out what being the beloved Son of God really means. Because this is a story where Jesus proves who he is, not by seizing power, but rather by turning it down. So, turn these stones into rocks? No, because the scripture says we don't live by bread alone. There's more to life than just your appetites. You know, just getting up in the morning and getting food into you, to get energy to go to work, to get money, to buy food, to get energy into you, to go to work, to get money, to buy food, round and round. There's more to life than that. But life is when you find yourself in a bigger story spoken over you by the Creator, and you get plugged into that purpose. Jump off this building and demand special protection. No, it doesn't work that way. God is not a slave to be there at my beck and call. He doesn't have to perform magic tricks just for me to know that he cares for me. Take control of the kingdoms of the world. You, get out of here. And you know what happened? Jesus emerged out of the desert knowing who he really was, because those tests had done their work. He really was the Son of God. And that means beloved by God, even when he's starving, even when he's all alone and being sorely tempted by the devil himself, even when there's every plausible reason to rise up and take control and become God's rival, he won't do it. He'll remain God's child instead, because he knows who he is, and the desert has now revealed it. And he can go forward now in his ministry in confidence. And Luke tells us in his version of this that when he did so, he did it full of the power of the Spirit. Now let's begin to land the plane today as we come to communion. What does all this have to say to us? Well, I want to suggest a couple of things. First of all, contrary to all normal expectations, the desert is a place of strength. You know, a good number of years ago now, I had a strange thing happen to me. You're probably not surprised that strange things happen quite a lot. But I received in the post an anonymous gift. And it was a framed picture of The Temptation of St. Anthony by the Spanish artist Salvador Dalí. I brought it with me today. You may not be able to see it all the way back, but this is it here. It's a picture of a desert landscape, and St. Anthony is down here in the corner, almost naked, and he's holding up as he kneels a cross. That's all he has to defend himself against these huge figures that are coming towards him. What's coming toward him? Well, there's a parade of elephants led by a horse. And that horse is meant to represent the devil. And they're all huge, stretched out, overwhelming, you know, imposing on these long, spindly legs. And they're meant to symbolize the terrible, relentless power of Satan's approach. And the elephants are all carrying, you can't see it from there, but they're all carrying on top of them symbolic objects representing temptation. So there's a statue of a nude woman holding her breasts. There's an obelisk. There's a vertical tower. There's a building confining another nude torso, probably representing a brothel. And these were the symbols of the temptation that Anthony sought to resist. Unbridled sexual desire, power, ego, greed. And in his weakness, the only thing he had to ward them off was the power of the cross. Maybe you're wondering, what on earth, you know, who on earth would have sent you this? Well, this was over 12 years ago. I highly suspect it was the chap that worked in the printer's office up the road from the church. I looked it up. See, it was pretty pricey. You're wondering, well, why did he send it? Well, number one, either he wanted me to keep on fighting the good fight, or number two, maybe it was a less spiritual reason, you decide. But I actually was never able to put it up in the house anywhere because it always felt a little bit intense to me. I've taken the frame off it and left it now as it is. But it's actually an example of a real thing that happened. Because did you know that with the rise of cultural Christianity in the 4th century, when it went from being this persecuted thing to being a really fashionable thing, and the emperor of the day made it the religion of the empire, when that happened, many thousands of people felt that their faith was being compromised, and so they left civilization behind and they went off into the deserts of North Africa, Judea, Syria. But they went there not for a rest, but they went for a spiritual war. You see, for them, the Eremos, the desert, was not a place to slow down and breathe and decompress, but it was a place to battle with your demons. And that's what gave the rise to hermits and monks and monastic orders. And they said, you know, we've got to go out here and do battle with our threefold enemy, that unholy trinity, the world, the flesh, and the devil. Have you heard that before? So the world was like, you know, the system of values and ideas of a broken world. The flesh is your own animal drives for self-gratification. And the devil is that animating force of evil in the world and in your own soul. And when you're out here in solitude and it's quiet and it's lonely and there's only you and your mind and distractions and noise are taken away, that's where you'll encounter all three. And you'll find yourself not in some private therapeutic wellness spa, but in a war zone. It's like St. Anthony. He said that in those really freezing cold desert nights, when his body was racked with fasting, his mind was hot with desire, as all he could see was dancing girls. And here's the thing, you see, the Spirit still leads us here. Okay, maybe not to a literal physical desert, not to run away with the monks or join up to a nunnery, but to a quiet place. A place of self-imposed stillness, solitude, getting alone with yourself before God. It's actually one of the things that I'm really grateful for in my evangelical background. It's that insistence on getting into the discipline of a daily quiet time, of having that time set apart every day when you just come aside, you still your heart, and you talk to God, and you let God talk to you. Now, obviously, I know that that can become a very legalistic thing. I still cringe whenever I think of some of the things I used to hear from the pulpit, like no Bible, no breakfast. Have you heard that one before? And it can become like a bit of another stick to beat you with. But nevertheless, having said that, there is something about it, about, you know, setting that space aside, whether it's in the morning or the afternoon or the nighttime, just to let the waters be still and run deep. Because we're so drugged by distraction. Get up in the morning, first thing, TV is on, music's on, you're scrolling through your phone, there's 101 things to do. But when you realize that the desert is actually the place of strength, then you become intentional about it. And there's two things that I've learned about this. Number one, that when I fail in my own life to keep up those rhythms of solitude, then that leads to the shortening of my own soul, and I get cranky and clogged up and overburdened and joyless. And the second thing is that I've noticed that people who spend a good time in solitude are some of the most tranquil people you'll ever meet. They radiate inner peace, not because it's kind of just drizzled over them, but because it was won in the struggle. Because the desert is the place of strength. And the second and last thing I want to say today is this, that not only is it the place of strength, but it's the place of revelation, where you find out who you are. You know, this week I heard a funny story that's quite relevant to all of this. So a little bird was flying south for the winter, and the wee bird was so cold, it was so cold up there that it froze. It fell to the ground in a large field. And while it was lying there, a cow came by and dropped some dung on it. And as the frozen bird lay there in a pile of cow's dung, it began to realize how warm it was, and the dung was actually thawing him out. And he lay there all warm and happy and snug, and he soon began to sing with joy. But a passing cat heard that bird singing and came to investigate. And following the sound, the cat discovered the bird under the pile of cow dung, promptly dug him out and ate him. Three little lessons from that story. I'm going to borrow a word that Lucy Mulholland taught me last year at Greenbelt. Number one, not everyone who yikes on you is your enemy. Number two, not everyone who gets you out of the yite is your friend. And number three, you see, when you're deep in the yite, it's best to keep your mouth shut and just stay in stillness. It's hard, isn't it, at times, to untangle the voices and the chatter in your head. Sometimes they rise up. You don't know what's you, what's God, what's the devil, what's for you, what's against you. We see in this passage that the devil quotes scriptures as much as anyone. But going to the desert means rather than drowning them out with distraction, shoving them away, you allow those fears, those insecurities, those accusations to rise up like demons and to face them down, and then emerging through that to a place of peace and confidence and trust. Like Jesus, who battled the voices, didn't get into dialogue with them, he didn't entertain them or have a debate with them, he didn't give them lots of airtime, but he redirected them to what he knew to be true. And he said, "It is written, it is written." I remember watching Mandela, you know, about the life of Nelson Mandela, and about how that great man managed to embrace the path of forgiveness and reconciliation after what had been done to him by the apartheid regimes, after what he himself had done on a career of violence. And he said that it was all those years spent in prison. Do you know how many years? 27. 18 of which were spent on Robben Island, which is kind of South Africa's version of Alcatraz. He said it was what those years, that's what did it to him. Because when it was when he was in the silence, that's when he truly saw his own soul. He saw his own feelings. He saw his own need for forgiveness. And it was in the silence, trying to face up to his own failures, his own need of forgiveness, that's when he became committed to the path of forgiveness and reconciliation for all people. And he went on to become the great man that he did with his best years before him. You see, it's the effect the desert has. It shows you who you are. And for some of us, that happened during lockdown, didn't it? I remember for me, up until lockdown, I kept myself distracted with 1,000 things. I told you a few weeks ago, 5 months before that happened, my life had just been flipped upside down. Remember the story where the man came into the cafe and took the most painful private thing I was wrestling with and flung it out to the world? But after that happened, you know, we had this crazy busy cafe to look after. And so for 5 months, I succeeded in keeping my head buried in the sand. And then, bang, COVID hit. And we all went into shutdown, and there was nowhere to run anymore. And sitting alone in my house, there was no one to talk to, there was nowhere to go, and all the stuff started to rise up. All the fears, all the turmoil, all the weaponized Bible texts, all the accusation, all the shame, all the repressed pain of 20 years, and it was agony. I'll never forget that day in my living room when it came to a head. And I had a moment of clarity, and I look back at it now as a watershed moment. And sitting in my living room, I realized that there were two paths before me, either fear or love. I was at a crossroads. And I realized in that moment that I was going to either spend the rest of my life leaning into the fear, which I had done for so long, you know, fear of myself, fear of God, fear of the texts, fear of being wrong, fear of hell. Or I was going to spend it leaning into love. And that's when the scripture came with such power to me. 1 John 4, there is no fear in love, but perfect love drives out all fear. He that feareth is not made perfect in love, because fear has torment. But we love him because he first loved us, and it was like a light bulb moment. And I remember making a decision from that moment that I was going to spend however many days that were left leaning into that love, daring to trust it was there, daring to stake my hopes on it, daring to believe that there was a benevolence at the heart of the universe. And that's when everything began to change. Now listen, as we prepare to finish today, I guess that's just what I want to pass on to you. Is that this story in Matthew chapter 4 is chiefly about Jesus and his identity. But whenever you belong to him, it's also about yours as well. There's plenty of times when the devilish voices will rise up in your head. Those voices that dehumanize you, to degrade you, to make you feel that your value is questionable, to make you question your belovedness by God. Voices to say to you, do you honestly think, given your track record and all the decisions that you've made, that you can come back from this again? Voices to say, you know, if you really are loved by God, if you really are a child of God, do you not think that life should be better than this? You know, do you not think if God's favor was on you that you'd be trouble-free, that you'd be happier, healthier, safer, richer? You know, when those voices come next time, you know what to do, don't you now? You've read the story. Pardon my French, but you just say back, you get the hell out of here. Because I'd rather be a hungry child of God than to be a well-fed player on your team. And if you can do that, chances are before long you'll hear another voice in your head, 10,000 times more beautiful than the first. And it will say to you, this is my beloved child, in whom I am well pleased. And you know, once you have that, you don't need to go around the whole world seeking for validation and approval and affirmation like a bee from flower to flower to flower to flower. You don't need that. You don't need anyone else to tell you who you are or to tell you, you know, what you know yourself, because now you know who you are. As you listen to that one voice, it is enough. You know, as the band come up to get ready now and lead us for communion, I just want to prepare to come to this bread and this cup now just by closing with a quick story that I often tell the young lads down in Overstown. And it's a story, a Cherokee story, Cherokee Indians, how they have this rite of passage practice for boys as they are emerging into adulthood. And so the father will take his son to a forest, he'll blindfold him, and then he'll leave him alone. And to pass the test, that boy is required to sit on a stump or a log all night long and not remove the blindfold until the morning sun begins to shine through it. He cannot cry out for help from anyone. But if he survives the night, then he is now a man. And so obviously terrified, the boy sits there alone in the dark, blindfolded. And as he does, his mind begins to play tricks on him. And so if the wind blows the grass or the trees, he begins to hear all kinds of noises and thinks that wild animals are ready any moment to jump on him and devour him. But he must sit still, no matter what. Never remove that blindfold, because that's the only way he can become a man. And finally, after a fearful night, the sun appears and he can remove the blindfold. And do you know what he discovers when he does? He discovers that just across from him is his father. Though without the boy ever knowing, that father was there the entire night, unbeknownst, protecting him, watching over him in case anything should harm him, keeping watch, never leaving his side, not for a single moment. He was always there, even when he didn't know. And you see, that's our wonderful reality too. I'm going to invite you all to stand this morning. We're going to come to the communion table now. And remember not only who we are, but remember whose we are. And so on the same night in which he was betrayed, Jesus took the bread. And after he had given thanks, he said, "Take, eat, this is my body broken for you. This do as often as you eat in remembrance of me." And in the same way, he took the cup, and when he had supped, he said, "This cup is the new covenant in my blood shed for many for the forgiveness of sins. This do as often as you drink it in remembrance of me."